From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Protesters gathered this weekend outside the homes of Supreme Court justices who might vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, while the Senate moves to vote this week on a bill that would essentially codify Roe and legalize abortion nationwide. Plus, where does the war in Ukraine stand as Russia celebrates Victory Day, the anniversary of its defeat of the Nazis in World War II? Welcome, I'm Paul Gigot of the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and here with two of my colleagues, Kim Strassel and Kyle Peterson. Welcome to you both. Let's start with the political fight that's already raging over abortion after last week's draft of an opinion, that last week's leak of a draft opinion that would overturn Roe and allegedly has five votes to do it. Let's listen to the protests in front of the homes of Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Chief Justice John Roberts.
Safe and legal, keep abortion. Safe and legal, keep abortion. Safe and legal, keep abortion. The whole world is watching. The whole world is watching. The whole world is watching.
The whole world is watching.
The whole world is watching.
The whole world is watching.
Well, Kim, that's some charming weekend fun at your home if you happen to be a judge. Joe Biden's spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, said today that the president does not support those kinds of protests in front of homes and that judges have an important responsibility and they shouldn't be subject of intimidation. I think that's the first time he said that. And a marked change from last week when Psaki had more or less taken a hands-off attitude saying that the president supports the right to protest, notwithstanding that things are getting pretty ugly and heated. Do you think the president had to speak up on this?
Yeah, he did, and I'm glad to see that he has. But it, as you note, it's a little bit late because what happened here is an activist group, which has called itself Ruth Sent Us, put and published the names and addresses of all of the justices on a map and called for people to mobilize. It was very clear that this was going to happen over the weekend. And yet when Psaki was asked about it in the beginning, she was a bit glib and said that peaceful protest, the right to do that, seemed to have no limits, and moreover said that she had no official position on where people protest, which seemed to give license to the idea that it was okay to go and stand outside these justices' houses. One of the problems, though, obviously, is that we do have some rules about this. Virginia has laws against picketing. Montgomery County, which is where some of the justices, including Brett Kavanaugh, live, also have rules against picketing in front of a person's home. Some people have mentioned there's a federal statute as well that makes it, you can be in trouble. It's a federal crime potentially to try to influence a judge or a jury by standing outside of their residence. So the police did show up here in some of these cases and a lot of the crowd dispersed, but still a very ugly scene in a number of places.
Montgomery County, of course, is in Maryland. Kyle, the fence has gone up around, a new fence has gone up around the Supreme Court building. Ilya Shapiro, who's a contributor to us, said on our TV show on the weekend that he has been told that Justice Alito and his family have moved for now to an undisclosed location. I've not been able to confirm that, but it does suggest, of course, Justice Alito, the author of this draft opinion, does suggest that there's real concern at the court about potential threats to justices.
Yeah, and we know that a justice's vote on an opinion is not final until the opinion comes out. And so there have been cases in the past where a judge or a justice, you know, it becomes incapacitated and that vote does not count. And then some of those decisions end up going the other way as a result of that. And I think that this threat of something like that happening is on the leaker, the person who leaked this document into the public, should have thought about this and known that this was a real possibility when he gave that draft opinion to a reporter. The other point I would just make about these protests is I think it's a quite damaging precedent. And the idea that there is no more private life anymore for people in public office. Some of these justices have young kids. We don't know if they were home at the time when there were crowds chanting, yelling outside their front doors. But where's the line? I mean, are they going to be protested at their kids' basketball tournaments? And it's hard not to note, I would also add, that a lot of this is coming from one side, and maybe part of it is just that protest is a young person's game, but recall the other precedents of Ted Cruz being hounded out of a restaurant a couple years ago, Congresswoman Maxine Waters saying if you see anybody from the Trump cabinet in a restaurant or a department store at a gas station, get out and create a crowd. And it would be nice to have the president come out more forcefully against this stuff.
Well, that's, I think, an important point Kyle makes, Kim, which is that it's coming from one side here. Of course, the people on the left who are upset with the potential Roe decision. But this, I mean, I'm not saying, my point is not that people on the right don't go overboard and don't do things that are unacceptable. They do. But if you're looking at the last couple of years, the whole protest theme, the idea that getting into the streets and putting pressure on people, that became a very powerful and a widespread tactic after the George Floyd murders and before leading up to the election. And there are a lot of people who think it was actually quite effective in creating the sense of disorder and a larger chaos that hurt Donald Trump. Now, I don't think that's why he lost the election, but did it hurt him? Maybe, among some voters, you know, kind of fit into the Biden theme of stop the madness of the Trump era, the general sense of political tension. And now this is an attempt, clearly, to intimidate the justices. Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas, said it's not going to work in a statement that he thought that people are trying to attack and undermine institutions. I think Thomas is right about that.
Yeah, and it's disheartening when you see leaders actually continue to encourage that behavior. I would note that both of the leaders of the Democratic House and the Democratic Senate, obviously Chuck Schumer made that famous comment after Kavanaugh was confirmed, saying that you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price, which was a very threatening thing. He later apologized, said he wished he hadn't used those words. But I would note that Nancy Pelosi, just in the last few days, asked what people should do right now in response to the draft opinion. And she pointed out that public sentiment is everything and can get a lot of things accomplished, and noted that it was important to point out that the final decision hadn't been made yet, and that we needed to take action in terms of public sentiment to make sure that the final decision doesn't go that far as the draft was that was out, which certainly seemed to also be a call to people to protest and go out. And the worry here is that things become ever more extreme. Some may have seen the news this weekend. Wisconsin Family Action, which is a conservative group in Madison that supports, among other causes, a pro-life agenda. Its main office was attacked. Graffiti was written on it saying, if abortions aren't safe, then you aren't either. Someone threw a Molotov cocktail through the window, and while it did not go off, it set one of the walls on fire. You know, we're still seeing very, very aggressive and violent protests as a result of this in places like Portland. And if you aren't having leaders that are condemning this wholeheartedly, then you're going to see more of it.
All right. We can hope that it dies down some. Kyle, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, going to bring to the floor this week, he's saying, maybe as early as Wednesday, a bill, a version of which has passed the House already, which would essentially codify Roe v. Wade and make abortion legal across the country. Why don't you tell our listeners actually what's in this bill?
Well, it would do a lot beyond codifying Roe v. Wade, and that's the reason that some people who are even supportive of that idea, and here I would point to Republican Senators Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, are against this bill. And a few things that I would point out. One is that I've mentioned on this program before, previous versions of this Democratic bill included an exception saying they would not overrule state laws that require minors to have parental consent or notification before getting an abortion, and that provision is no longer in the current bill. So that's something that's being pointed to. There's a provision saying that people seeking an abortion before fetal viability, before that was the line that was drawn originally in Roe, cannot be asked the reason that they are seeking an abortion. And so there are some states that have tried to outlaw sex-selective abortion in the past few years, and courts have been skeptical, I believe, of those under the Roe and Casey framework. But the idea is basically that the states don't think you should be able to abort a girl just because you wanted a boy, for example. And that's something, a choice that this bill would seem to protect. Another thing that these two Republican senators are pointing out is the bill exempts itself from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And so they're saying that it undermines crucial conscience protections for religious liberties, including for religious healthcare workers. And so there's a bunch of stuff in this bill, and some of it, to me, looks like it is on the far side of where public opinion is. And so, I mean, that's one reason that I would caution Senator Schumer here, as I think he's picking some fights that maybe he doesn't realize the public opinion is on the wrong side of. The other one is just that if the Senate is going to codify national abortion policy, I don't see why he's not opening the door for Republicans next time they're in power to do the same. And then we're going to have national abortion policy hinge on, you know, who wins the Senate race in Georgia.
First, I want to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this vote in the Senate this week and the war in Ukraine after 2.5 months.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel and Kyle Peterson. And Kyle was mentioning before the break about this vote on a national bill that would set abortion policy for all 50 states. I just would elaborate on that. I think it is constitutionally suspect at the very least, if not outright unconstitutional. And here's why I say that. The states have, under the Constitution, have reserved to them police powers over things like most criminal statutes, blue laws, things like that. And before Roe, of course, that included abortion policy. Now, if Roe goes away, then there's a real question of whether or not the federal government can come in and order the states to allow something that is banned in some states or restricted in some states. And as Kyle suggested, this could open it up to Republicans who might want to pass a national ban on abortion when they come in. Now, I don't think either of the parties have the votes to do that in the Senate, get over a filibuster. The Democrats withholding this vote are saying, we do think it is legal to pass a national abortion bill. And I'm not sure it is, particularly since if the Roe is overturned, the argument that the 14th Amendment applies to the states and to abortion law, that goes away. Okay, that's eliminated. So then the justification for this national bill would have to be, under the Constitution, the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which allows the federal government, with limits, to regulate commerce among the states. But if you're allowed to order a state to perform an activity like abortion to be performed in states, or to ban it in states, to allow it in states where it's banned, or to ban it in states where it is legal, the federal government is basically usurping that police power, Kim.
Yeah, I think the key words you just used there with regard to the Commerce Clause was with limits. There's obviously a long history of jurisprudence dealing with the Commerce Clause and some odd anomalies in that jurisprudence as well, too. But overall, the court has understood that there are limits on the use of saying the federal government can regulate activity unfettered in the states because there are other restrictions on doing that. And it seems very hard to me that this particular court, having just gone, if they do issue a final draft opinion that overturns Roe v. Wade, would then also be the same court that expands the Commerce Clause to the degree that it would allow a bill of the type that Schumer is putting forward. It wouldn't make a lot of sense because it would be an extremely broad reading of the Commerce Clause. It just seems unlikely with this court. And look, Chuck Schumer knows that as well, too, which just underlines to the degree to which it's probably constitutionally suspect. He doesn't have the 60 votes to put this through anyway. This is very clearly a messaging vote designed to make senators on both sides put their name down, aye or nay, which they hope to use politically this fall. There's some interesting stuff coming out now about how effective that will actually be. Reuters did a very fascinating interview over the weekend asking 21 women who live in Maricopa County, which is a northern suburb of Phoenix. These are all suburban mothers, how they feel about this. Interestingly, the 16 that said that they were pro-choice, only two of them considered abortion a priority. The rest of them were far more concerned about jobs and inflation.
All right. This debate is going to continue, and as particularly once the final opinion in the abortion case comes down. So we'll be saying a lot more about this in future shows. Let's take up Ukraine. 10 weeks into the war, Vladimir Putin today gave a speech in front of a parade, military parade in central Moscow. Putin did not declare victory, also did not, as some feared, announce an escalation in his war in Ukraine, although the fighting is very, very rugged and difficult in many parts of the conflict there in eastern Ukraine. But Putin did use the occasion to justify the war, and he assailed NATO and the United States for supporting Ukraine. Meanwhile, Ukraine is staging some offensive operations to try to push Russians back from different parts of the eastern Ukraine where it's advanced. Kyle, 10 weeks or so into this, everybody thought May 9th would be the day that Vladimir Putin declared victory, and it looks like it's more like a non-victory day.
Yeah, and I would say that people thought victory was coming in a matter of a few days when Russians moved on the capital of Kiev initially, and that estimate explains some of the slowness, I think, of the White House, President Biden, in giving this aid out to Ukraine. But to his credit, I think that he has been pretty stalwart on saying that this is a situation that the United States, Americans can't look away from and have some responsibility to help with. And one thing I would note is on Friday, he issued another statement saying that there's some more funding coming, but that the administration has nearly exhausted the funding that can be used to send security assistance. And so he is calling on Congress again to provide more funding, a re-up on that. And it looks like that we're about at the end of the limits here, where President Biden is getting to the point where he won't be able to send any more ammunition, any more howitzers, any more material until he gets that funding of Congress. And I think that, you know, that's what Congress should be focused on in the next couple of days.
Kim, and it looks like Congress is dragging its feet on this. Nancy Pelosi is saying now, oh, we'll get to this by the end of the month. But part of that, it seems to be a calculation of how she can work this in with their requirement for COVID funding. And they'd also like some funding for other things. But Ukraine needs this money now. And given the success that I think that Kyle mentioned of Ukraine and all of the U.S. officials now who are parading through Kyiv. You had Joe Biden, to her credit, going into Ukraine this weekend. You had defense and secretaries of defense and state there not too long ago. And the G7 met virtually with Zelensky over the weekend, talked about its commitment. Europe is toughening up on an embargo on Russian oil that will be rolled out over the next few months. They're getting a lot more serious. Why can't Congress act?
Yeah, it's really depressing to see, especially because we have, at the same time, as you mentioned, been toughening up even our own rhetoric. One thing that really stuck out at me about that G7 phone call with Zelensky was that the group came out and vowed to protect both Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity to support that. And I liked the territorial part because it's become very clear that Russia's new goal is to simply seize some portion of Ukraine, likely to restage and engage in more operations in the future. So that was great. But Congress is just so dysfunctional. This continues to be wrapped up, as you said, in this emergency COVID funding that the White House has put forward. Democrats refused to step back on some of their other priorities in that COVID bill, which is what has turned Republicans against it. There's a big fight over how to reclaw some of the money that would be used for that. And because it's in a perilous position as a standalone bill, Democrats are intent on trying to attach it to something else that must pass. And their obvious selection is this Ukraine bill. But it needs to have been done yesterday. It's now going on more than 2 weeks or almost 2 weeks since the president asked for that. As Kyle mentioned, the drawdown facility is getting very near. And there's no urgency. Last week, Nancy Pelosi said, oh, we'll get it done next week. Now she's saying, oh, well, we hope to get it done by the end of the month. This is not providing Ukraine the support it needs or the support that we've in fact pledged.
Well, listening to Putin's speech, then you would conclude that he's nowhere near pulling out of Ukraine or declaring victory such as it is and going home. So this is likely to be a longer-term conflict. It's likely to continue. Russia is, and the Kremlin really do have an enormous capacity to tolerate Russian casualties. So that means Ukraine is going to continue to need aid and military aid. And, you know, the United States has to lead on this. So we'll see. But I hope Biden keeps the pressure on, because remember, his party controls Congress and they control the ability to bring votes to the floor. All right. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Kim. And thank you all for listening. Be sure to send questions or comments to us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And we will be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.